Make an Ideology, a podcast about the 69th best show. Is it of all time? Is it of the 21st century? I don't remember the list anymore.
It's the 21st century.
Is it the 21st century? Yeah. I'm Ian, and I'm here as always with my co-host.
Ryan Swen. Hello.
Ryan, I have a really important question for you today as we cover the hours of 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. season 1 of 24. And I feel like you are uniquely qualified to answer this as both a much better scholar of film than I, and also a resident of the City of Angels. Is 24 a Western?
I can't say I expected that question. Well, I'll say that the scenes of Nina stumbling through the industrial area of LA kind of does remind me of Western.
I shades of Terrence Malick, in fact.
When we were talking about Los Angeles Plays Itself last week,
yeah,
there's a sequence in that where Tom Anderson talks about sort of like the ever present oil derricks of LA, like in films, and I think that's definitely. I didn't expect to see that so soon in 24, but like just them just pulling up to some oil derricks before Jack shoots Nina. Obviously, it takes place in a more industrial area, but still, like, it's this both that and also the stuff with Terry and Richard,
yes,
like, out in the hills. Though, of course, that's an entirely different invoked LA.
Yeah, area. Yeah. I think it was in the IMDb trivia that said the place where Nina gets shot is also they use the exact same location in a scene in LA Confidential.
Oh, of course.
Which I haven't seen. And I'm surprised, actually, that more of that hasn't cropped up. I mean, if you're filming and around Los Angeles, I think there'd be more connections like that. But also, like, I don't know who's chronicling these kind of things for the IMDb trivia section. So,
I mean, the type of people who adore LA Confidential. I haven't seen it myself. I'll probably like it. I don't know if I'll love it.
I'll probably like it, yeah. Yeah, that's my attitude toward most movies these days, you know. I'll probably like it. I tend not to watch things that I don't think I might like, so.
Well, I can't tell exactly how facetious or how pointed your question is about Westerns, but like there's a certain balance being struck in these two episodes, which I think, I mean, maybe it's just that we're getting more and more inculcated with like the rhythms of 24, but it feels like it's getting like, I don't know, maybe just like the storylines are more interesting. Like it gets like getting better.
Yeah.
And, like there's a sort of like... balance between like individual and like the group that's sort of being found.
Yeah, I mean, though, you know, like many of my questions, it's both ironic and completely serious. In that the thought,
which is also the description of our show.
Yeah, exactly. The thought occurred to me, yeah, particularly now that it's daylight and they're outside a lot in these two episodes. I thought, oh, this, particularly that scene with Nina, you know, she goes to like, I don't know, it's like some dusty old garage or something with that old computer and the phone, yeah, and all of that. And then I thought, well, yeah, you sort of have, you know, your renegade cowboy hero. You've got your band of outlaws, you know, with their maniacal ringleader in Ira. You have, you know, a political official, a local political official that's being protected, right? You know, you have this thin line between law and outlaw, with Jack kind of having to go over and across that line back and forth for understandable reasons, but still, yeah. I was just thinking, you know, and then of course, like, I think a lot of those things are things that happen in lots of movies. Mm-hmm. But it was really the setting that set off that particular thought of like, yeah, is this kind of doing a little bit of a Western thing? I don't know that it's a question that I feel like it's a question that is more interesting to think about than to like answer. Mm-hmm. But I was just having fun with that thought this afternoon.
Of course, this means that we'll likely have to watch one of the more odd choices. I mean, among many odd choices in Kiefer Sutherland's filmography, Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, he's in Cowboys and Aliens?
I'm pretty sure he is.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. He also...
Oh, no. Wait, no. Sorry. I'm wrong about that. Never mind.
Is he not in that? I've no, never seen it.
No, I think... maybe I was thinking of Daniel Craig.
I'm Bond-pilling you.
Oh, God.
Okay. Slowly. I'm incepting you with Bond pods. No, okay. But Kiefer Sutherland has made a Western with Donald Sutherland.
Oh yeah, maybe I was thinking of that. Yeah,
John Cassar, upcoming 24 auteur, the usurper to Stephen Hopkins.
Okay.
Who is back this week?
Yes, well, he's back for the second episode.
Yeah,
I think that maybe because like I sort of like, again, ironically but not ironically, brought in the sort of idea of Stephen Hopkins of tourism with like the sort of shots of like Jack's like framed against Palmer's advertisements in the first episode, and like you took it and ran with it. So I was like looking out more for it like this time. I mean, I sort of agree, but like it's also like a lot of it is like, I think the main thing that I noticed for me is like more emphasis on handheld or something like that.
Yeah, I think there's that. I will say though, you may not believe me, but I swear to you that this is true. I started watching this second episode that we have for this week, and I don't pay a lot of attention during the credits. That's kind of like when I'm like, you know, sitting on my couch and like getting my snacks ready or whatever. And about 15 minutes into the episode, I was like, damn, this is so much better directed than the last few episodes. And then I was like, is this a Stephen Hopkins episode? And it was. So I feel like your Stephen Hopkins auteur theory is really validated. I feel like, and obviously, you know, at some point this handover to, I honestly don't think he directs anything past season one, if I remember right.
I think until Legacy, yeah.
Yeah. But he is, as we've discussed, really responsible for the visual language of the show.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that someone like Cassar, because of their long tenure after this, probably takes that and does a lot of stuff with it that will become just as recognizable. But it's sort of been like this season, it's been like Stephen Hopkins and then like a gun for hire kind of TV guy. And they've all, you know, like they do interesting things with it. But really the Stephen Hopkins episode just felt like, oh yeah, this is the guy who came up with how this show should look.
Yeah, I can sort of see that. I mean, like, in the opening credits of episode 7, there's these interesting sort of like pans across, like as the sun is rising, like that, like a sort of like rapidly dissolves to like as it's panning to show like Ira at his computer station.
Yeah,
his sort of cavalcade of gadgetry, which we see a lot of in these two episodes. And then it goes to not Martin Belkin.
I actually
kind of like those, but like they're definitely a different sort of thing, and like that one's by Brian Spicer, so like there's a different sort of a feel to them than like the Stephen Hopkins stuff, which is like probably more dynamic, you know, like there's just like a better like a sense for, well, it helps that episode is like a very much like a pivotal one in terms of bringing the storylines more and more together.
Yeah, it's a great episode of the show, like I think maybe the best one so far.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
This is not to rag on Spicer, who actually I think in episode 7 does some interesting stuff. Uses the like the panels in particular in a way that sort of feels like really propulsive, which is not something that Hopkins does as much. Hopkins is more about the visual language, and Spicer seems to be about kind of like using them to like ratchet things up. It was just so fun. I was just like losing it because I was like, you could feel that Stephen Hopkins touch, even if you're a dumbass and you're not paying attention at the beginning of the show.
I mean, there's just like so much that happens in these episodes. Like, it's not really quite that the setup is done. I think a lot of the setup is still there, especially with like the Palmer stuff.
Yeah.
And like a classic sort of 24 twist to like have him cut off right before he can actually talk about what happened, and there's a certain something that like I didn't expect to feel, but like which I do think is that like I think Jamie's kind of done dirty by these episodes, like not in the fact that she's a mole, but like just how it revealed it, like it just didn't quite like land as impactfully as I expected. Maybe because partly because it wasn't at the end of an episode, partly because it's just like more about Terry being kidnapped than it is about Jamie's actual mole revelation.
Yeah. So again, I'm sort of dumb, in some ways, but I did not make the inference when the fake CTU guys show up that meant that Jamie was responsible. Because we know they have like all the cameras and phones tapped and stuff like that. So for that episode, at least, it was sort of like, oh yeah, they just like they've got the place on lock, you know. I didn't immediately think that it was Jamie. And again, this is partially my extremely fuzzy memory of having watched the show, right? Like, these smaller beats are still revelations to me. But yeah, it's just sort of dumb. Like, she isn't the whole, like, when we finally get to sort of like Nina and Tony really ganging up on her, you know, screaming and yelling, etc.
That's a good scene.
Yeah,
it is. They're like bad copying her. It's fantastic.
It's so good.
It's like slamming the metal grating on the computer server.
Yes. It's just a great. I just love in this show when people get angry. but she has like no real explanation. It's not like they've blackmailed her or done it. It's just like, yeah, these people contacted me and told me to like betray all the people I work with and like sell this information from this like vital government, secret government entity that I work for, you know? And I just said, that sounds fine and nobody will get hurt. It just seems like really dumb in a way. Like, the show is often very dumb, but it's sometimes dumb in like a productive and entertaining way. And this just didn't seem like that. Although I do love the multiple scenes we get of her going into the bathroom stall and basically opening up her notes app to receive text messages.
We have to talk about that PDA. Oh, I didn't realize it was a PDA because I'm young and I think I had a... I don't think I ever had a PDA. But how does this work? Like, Ira Gaines says it, like says his instructions, then it comes out complete with a yes or no prompt.
It's entirely magic technology. as far as I can tell, it basically, like, one, the voice to text is flawless. And I don't know that you've ever used current voice to text, but there's no way CTU has this kind of voice to text technology. Like, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist now. It will probably not exist in the future. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, like, if the technology is so sophisticated that it can, like, flawlessly transcribe a question, why on earth would you have this simple yes? Like, why would you confine it to yes or no questions? And then, of course, you know, like, again, this is something that I found in the IMDb trivia. Like, I noticed it as I was watching it, but the way that they phrase it in the trivia section is like, Jamie's supposed to be receiving messages using her PDA. However, you can clearly see, quote, memo X of 3 above each of the messages, showing that they were pre-written onto the PDA. It's like, you know, I mean, I think to some degree the show is like, it's about an entity that would obviously have like the cutting edge technology, but the television show itself does not have access to whatever the cutting edge military technology is, so they kind of have to make it up. Yeah, I mean, it's like, can't they see all the cameras? Like, maybe she could give a thumbs up, thumbs down to the camera. I mean, why even bother sending the messages, you know?
Yeah. I mean, also, it makes sense that CTU has, like, a surveillance camera in the women's room, but also, like, it's also crazy. Like,
yeah, it's a little...
I mean, technically, it's, like, not in the, like, facing in the stalls, but still, like,
it's pretty high up. I mean, some of those stalls, you can definitely see some of what's going on back there. I feel like that is a I don't know, who do you complain to about that? Is that like in OSHA's purview?
I feel like, I don't know, like, I was thinking more like HR, but like, I feel like 24 doesn't, like, CTU doesn't have an HR department.
CTU has an HR department, and they are even worse than the rest of CTU. HR is where they send you when it's like you've been too much of a maniac in the field.
Yeah.
And it's like they got to take your gun away. You don't get company vehicles, you know. You just got to sit in an office. Like that's where, you know, that's where they're going to try to send Jack Bauer eventually. It's like, "Jack, you got to work in HR. We can't have you out here doing this." And then those are the people you have to complain to. So of course, you know, none of those complaints are going to go anywhere.
Yeah. Before we stray too far from Jamie, first I have to note, I think this is, since this is not apparently told in the actual show, this is in the Findings at CTU book. apparently that, I think that Jamie apparently turned traitor because her father had recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and the family was facing the expenses of long-term nursing care. And she wouldn't have betrayed her country had she known that people would be killed. So
it's like, yeah.
You could say that. I mean, like, I don't know why she's asking for counsel.
I'm getting ahead of the show here, and maybe at some point she divulges this. But to me, if you're going to, like, she basically tells them, yes, I've been doing this and passing off this information. So if you're going to, like, confess to the thing, you know, like, one, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems like you want to ask for counsel before you confess to the crime that you're being accused of. That just seems like 101. And then also, if you're going to just go and confess to it, why not explain to your colleagues that I'm in this difficult family situation? I mean, it's not, when put that way, it's not that different from like Jack's situation.
Yeah.
In that, you know, they found a weak point and they're exploiting it, you know, and everybody presumably has those, you know, this is often how this kind of stuff happens. But yeah, you'd think that, like, I don't know, this scene would just go much differently if she just divulged that, right? And I think it would give us, like, I think the problem they've been having with her character is that, I mean, she's dropped off for whole episodes, basically, where they're like, we don't know what to do with this person. So it does feel like reaching for a storyline a little bit. But then also, you know, I mean, this is just in the show's tradition of just constant red herrings, right? Which is like, ah, now we have the mole, where... You don't actually have the mole yet. You know, you have a mole.
Yeah. I mean, but like that's, I don't think they're going to bring that up again. Like they're like even the hint that Nina might be a mole again for like probably 12 episodes or something like that.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how that drops off after the Jamie thing.
It'd be funny if like everything went entirely smoothly for the next 12 hours and then they like, returned at CTO. They're just like, oh, wait, we can do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, apparently Terry is on Mulholland Drive, which did tickle me. And you can see Jamie write down Mulholland and then later cross it off. And this is what, like 2-3 months after Mulholland Drive had its US run.
So, like, oh, that's sort of, like, beautiful.
There's like a certain, I don't know, maybe like the question is, did one of the writers see Mulholland Drive and decided to include it because of that?
My theory is that Mulholland Drive and 24 are actually happening at the same time. Mulholland Drive actually takes place on the day of the California primary. It just doesn't get mentioned.
It's like shampoo.
Oh man, that's another, we gotta add that to the 24 canon.
Oh, that's a good point. I haven't seen it actually.
I did just watch The Silent Partner. I was tweeting about it a little bit. And that that has a great villain turn from Christopher Plummer.
Right.
So I had just watched that and then watching these episodes, which are great Ira episodes. Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, really, he's flourishing into a great antagonist here. Because at first, you know, he's sort of like shadowy and you don't even quite know if he's like, and, you know, ultimately he's not, but you don't quite know if he's like the guy or if there's like another guy beyond him that we're going to get to, which, you know, eventually like the conspiracy is vast, et cetera. But
yeah, every 24 season has another guy. Definitely.
Yeah. A series of guys. but yeah, he's just, he's having fun. He's having
like you get to see his entire range in these like two episodes. Like in this first episode, like he's just like in control. Like he's just, you get to see him like put his like sandals up on the desk. You like he just like casually like fires a gun like next to the ear.
It's like, dude, your ear is there too.
Yeah,
how's that
like,
going
indoors
for you?
Also, like,
oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, when he reveals that he has the cameras inside CTU also, like, he just like makes like a ta-da gesture with his hands. Like, I can see you there too, Jack.
I love it when he's on the phone with Jack, Jack has just realized that that, you know, his wife is not with the person that she thinks she is, right? And he's like, and he says something like, well, and Jack's like, who is this guy? And Ira's like, well, he's not an accountant from the valley. It's so great. It's just having a great time.
And then at the end of the of episode 8, he's just like raging. He's like did you screw me, Jack? Yelling, and he gets like a maybe the best damn it in the show so far.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, and it's sort of weird because this episode, which I think, you know, we both agree is like the best one so far. It was the worst rated in the first season.
Yeah, I just saw that. It was bizarre. I mean, like, you would feel like that, like, maybe did people not like, because if I understand correctly, for like TV ratings, it's usually reflective of how people felt about the last episode.
Oh, you know, I could see that because the last episode isn't quite. It felt like the tires were spinning a little bit because they had to get the pieces in place, you know. Like,
I mean, a little, but I mean, like, you get Nina getting shot, and like,
that's true.
There's good. Like, there's good stuff in it. I mean, like, I don't think it's like necessarily markedly better or worse than the others. It's just like,
If I'm thinking purely, you know, purely plot wise, which is sort of like what TV is for, I guess.
Sure.
Like, I think that the Jack plot has really been working for a few episodes. And the other plots are kind of like going in and out of being as exciting, you know? So I did feel like in that episode that like when we cut away from the Jack thing, there just wasn't as much happening. I mean, this is the episode where Terry bashes Alan over the head, right? With the rock. And then like the whole episode is just, I guess he's like tied up and they're just kind of waiting there. And
she does a good job of tying him up.
Yeah.
Also, like with jumper cables, like it's just.
Yeah, she's very resourceful.
I like how his like voice sort of changes like when he's tied up there. Like he's sort of like, I don't know, like there's interesting things that they do. Like I think that I felt this in like the previous episode where it's revealed that he's bad, and then like and it happens again when Jamie's bad. It's like it feels like the entire episode is written around that, so like they automatically become more suspicious even before that moment. There is that nice moment where Jamie and Milo are just like when he's trying to fix it, and like there's like a, I don't know, it's like a flirtation sort of, but like it's
they have, you know, they have a little bit of a rivalry.
Definitely.
And he's kind of a douche, but there's like a little bit of chemistry there, you know. And it's like with the like Tony and Nina finally, after, you know, 8 episodes, sort of seem like, okay, I could sort of see how these two could be a couple, you know. And part of that is just a function of like Carlos Bernard finally gets to do something other than just like sit around and whine.
It's fun that like his first shot still in episode 7 is him like looking at a report, like a folder of reports,
just glowering at it. Yeah, it's great. I don't remember. I think it's this episode. I was just reading it. Now I can't find it. So maybe I'm making this up. But I think that it was that they originally aired, and I think it must be episode 8 because, you know, as I mentioned in the release of the most recent episode, like we're in 2002 now. It's a new year. And I think that, you know, maybe it was the first episode here. It was actually originally aired at like 3 a.m. on FX to basically like get inside the Golden Globe rules to be nominated.
Yeah.
And there was some controversy around that. And Kiefer Sutherland ended up winning the Golden Globe for actor in a television series because of that. But I thought that was very funny, the idea of just like tossing off this episode at 3 a.m. on your cable network.
I wonder, maybe that led people to think that it was actually airing at 3 a.m. the next time, and that's why the ratings were lower.
Yeah, maybe there was some confusion. Yeah, I could see that. And I think also, you know, I mean, I don't think it's unusual after the sort of, because I think there's at least a couple weeks in between these episodes and the last two we talked about, because usually around Christmas, you know, things kind of drop off. I'm not looking directly at the schedule right now, but I would guess, you know, you lose a little bit of your casual audience in that interim.
Right.
Maybe the, you know, people's schedules change, other stuff happens. Maybe they don't realize the show is back on, whatever, you know. But yeah, I thought it was notable that like easily, and maybe not easily, but the best episode of the season, I think, is the one that was the least watched.
Apparently, like, the least watched in, like, the first, like, six seasons or something like that.
Yeah. It's a real low point, which is a shame. And it also, it's one of the reasons it's good is because it has the benefit of, like, bringing a lot of things kind of to a close a little bit, or seemingly to a close.
It feels like it very much like this. I mean, like, we both know, like, it was originally contracted for 13 episodes. So, like, it feels like the midpoint also, which also sort of retroactively makes scenes like Terry and Kim like reconciling like sort of feel weird because there's still another 2/3 of the season left.
Oh yeah, so many hours left.
Yeah, so many hours. Like we're already 1/3 through, but there's you know a lot of episodes. But yeah, like there's a certain like you know like you said like sort of like bring things to close, but like also like bring people together, like some of whom like you wouldn't really see much together, but who feel like very integral. Like you get Pierce and Jack standing next to each other, and yeah. Jack is described in the episode as 5'11", but Kiefer Sutherland is 5'9", and Glenn Morshower is actually 5'11", and you could see the difference. Like, it's just, like he's sort of just like towering over Jack.
Kiefer Sutherland, my fellow 5'9" king.
I'm 5'8", so there's a.
Oh, this is good. That's as good as 5'9". Yeah.
More or less. I thought it was taller, but I guess not.
That's good. It definitely feels like more than any other point in the show so far, it definitely feels like moving into like one act from another, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it does make me wonder how the writer's room worked, right? Like, mm-hmm. were they constantly... I mean, I assume there was some... Actually, I don't assume that. It doesn't seem, from reading around the show for these past few weeks, it doesn't seem that there was really a big plan for how all this would go.
Yeah, I mean, it feels, A, like we said, like, it feels planned for 13 episodes.
Yeah.
And B, like, it's sort of, obviously the plan as they go along, but, like, it feels very much, centered around, like, this is, like, the plan.
Yeah.
This is the plan is to have, Jack frames like by giving him the gun and putting his fingerprints, and so like it even though he says like they'll get Palmer anyways, it just feels like very nebulous, like there's no plan whatsoever, like they're planning to wrap up the compound at the at that moment, so it's sort of a there's like a indefiniteness to it, which I think works because it's just very much in the moment, but also like it feels like I don't know what will happen next episode simply because it ends with Jack in custody. I mean, he's not on the earpiece anymore, so he can tell like what's happening with Kim and Terry, but still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that it's kind of this reversal, right, where Jack has really had to be improvising this whole time, and now Ira has to improvise, seemingly, you know, because it doesn't, like you're saying, it doesn't seem like there is a already formulated plan B to this. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe there is. Maybe in following episodes he'll be collected again.
Yeah, but I'm sure there is. But it's just like sort of like it feels very much like the show doesn't know. Like because it feels very unintegrated. Like the idea that there's another plan. Like this is like what it's been driving towards in very linear fashion. And like now that's gone, it doesn't like it's sort of not clear. But that at the same time sort of makes these individual episodes kind of stronger. Just because it feels focused to a large degree, like especially like the stuff I think with Nina and Tony works for that, because like they're like finally like enmeshed within the action, and Tony you get him with that headset and like the gun like going into the women's restroom,
it's so like, good.
Waiting for the 20-second loop, like it's just like, this goofy image, like.
Like again though, what is with those headsets? Like if Ira can have these, you know, invisible earpieces, why does CTU have these bulky, you know, in sync looking things?
I don't know. Speaking of Ira, there were a few. I mean, I assume that we'll keep talking about Ira moments simply because there's just so many good ones. But one where he's like talking with Rick, and he's And Rick offers to say, we can wait to for you to pay me, and he says, "Why? That's very kind of you."
Rick is so stupid. It's like, it's like he knows you're up to something, man. Like this is a smart guy, you know.
Well, I mean, Rick does get a guy or two to be dumber than him, so that he looks smart in comparison in these episodes.
Yeah, he's definitely helped by the fact that, like, Ira does not seem to have a very good hiring policy. He's not sending his best.
That's true.
We were talking about, I'm going backwards in the conversation, but we were talking about David Lynch earlier, so I think it's worth noting that Michael Massey is in Lost Highway.
Oh, wow.
He plays Andy, and I frankly don't remember who that is. I've only seen Highway once. There's a lot of minor characters floating around. That's true. So.
I mean, there's a lot of Lynch always has his sort of like faces.
Yes.
You know, like sort of like faces that aren't really really explicated on, but
yeah.
Oh, apparently he throws the party that the mystery man shows up at.
Okay.
So, a fairly big part, but there's only four people that I really remember from Lost Highway, which I love, but like it's sort of
yes.
very much built around those four people and no one else really. So,
but that's another sort of Lynch connection that I found interesting. This is a point where I'm really glad you suggested watching two episodes for each podcast episode, because I really feel like I would struggle to like not talk about these episodes in conjunction with each other, because they do feel like they flow fairly well together. Mm-hmm. They're more conjoined in some ways than some of the other episodes. Obviously, like the plot is sort of relentlessly linear, but it really does feel like a lot of the stuff that gets set up in episode 7 gets addressed in episode 8, which is not always the case in the show.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to what you were saying about like sort of Jack improvising, like I think like that's something I always like about the show's just like Jack Bauer trying to figure out a problem.
Yeah.
But like I also like I sort of forgot that how brute force or like how like what like one action leads to the result it is.
Yeah.
Like with him like knocking over Milo's pistachios so he could switch the key card.
Classic.
I don't know, I wonder if they were planning on having him like snacking on pistachios so that they could do that, or if it was just like
I think that's pure Kiefer. I feel like that was improv. He came in there and he just took over the scene and said, here's what I'm going to do.
And then him like pulling the gun on Nina.
Yeah.
Just in order to get out of that situation.
Yeah.
Just like the most brute force option possible.
He's sort of like MacGyver if MacGyver's answer was always, let's shoot somebody. And, you know, most of the time he gets out of it. So I do think we do have an episode, the first of the series, where nobody dies.
Yeah, I was about to mention that.
Yeah.
An amusing thing to note. I mean, I guess it's possible that I just forget when people die. Like, I was I had the same thing as you had, where I was trying to think back. Who died in episode 1? I was like, oh, everyone in the plane.
An entire plane full of people that we don't care about.
Yeah, exactly. The Nina stuff. I mean, it's interesting. I find it funny that they sort of threw in that bit with Tony looking at the surveillance footage, seemingly only that he could say, oh, why is she wearing a flak jacket?
Yeah, like
It seems explicitly there just to be about that, just to reveal that. Also, I'm pretty sure that a flak jacket wouldn't actually work against bullets, because like the shrapnel is like more, I mean, maybe I read this somewhere that flak jackets wouldn't work against bullets, but I can't quite remember.
I'm a rube who's willing to believe just about anything, but I just don't think that jacket is going to do what you want it to do at point blank range.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe CTU has just the best flak jackets money can buy. Maybe that's why they don't have good headsets. They spend all their money on flak jackets. it does feel like, you know, it does feel like one of those moments where it's like, okay, you the viewer have watched this thing happen and you might have some questions, so let's directly address your questions instead of just kind of letting things spool out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Tony is low-key, you know, kind of a dumb guy too, so maybe that's, you know, I mean, again, a generous reading is that there's a little bit of character work going on there. Yeah, I mean, I think like Carlos Bernard does a lot more with the character as the show goes on, but
yeah,
you know, for this season, he's sort of like constantly behind, constantly trying to catch up, like out of the loop, sort of has that kind of whiny, incredulous voice all the time. But then, you know, he springs into action, like to his credit.
Yeah, I mean, it's just cool, that idea of, I mean, looping cameras is always a thing that you expect to see happen in movies, but it's sort of just fun seeing it here. Just I mean, it's sort of funny that they almost kiss, but they don't kiss on the lips. It's quite amusing to me. Sids is still like, I wonder if the writers remember that they're actually in a relationship or not.
Yeah, you know, there's a weird vibe going on there. I don't know what that's about. Tony obviously still kind of hung up on the idea of Nina being with Jack. He's
Yeah.
obviously threatened by Jack. So I don't know, maybe they have some intimacy issues. I'm not sure. But like, you know, when, you know, they're finally like kind of co-conspirators and they have that moment, you know, she takes a taxi to CTU and then he lets her in like the back door or whatever.
Yeah, he wrote down the address, but she ended up taking a taxi. I don't quite remember. Like, did he call a taxi off screen or something like
That was what my assumption was, that he sent a taxi to get her, which, you know, is not a bad plan. But I don't quite, you know, if she's supposed to be, you know, faking her own death, then like CTU seems like a bad place for her to be, considering that there's cameras everywhere and all of this stuff. But, you know, again, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief to get these characters on screen together. The last thing we need is more characters alone in rooms talking on phones. There's a lot of that.
Yeah, you have to be Ira Gaines in order to really pull that off. Like you have to have that sort of extra edge in order for it to work. Otherwise it can be fun, but like you can need it in bursts. You can't
Well, and
keep doing it.
it works so well with Ira because it's like a cat and mouse thing with Jack. You know, where it's like this sustained interaction over several episodes. Whereas sometimes it's like, okay, this character's just going to be in this room for a while talking on the phone, and you don't get like that long. Yeah, the Ira Jack thing is really, really great in these two episodes.
Speaking of cars, there's some good car moments in episode 7. There's one where like at the beginning where he's sort of at a stoplight and where Jack is at a stoplight and the police, like a police car rolls up next to him. And it sort of amused me mainly because Jack is at the stop, like waiting after the green light for a good 5 or 10 seconds. And in LA, there's no way nobody would honk. Like at 6 a.m., people are trying to get to work. No
6
one's no
a.m. on
one's
Tuesday.
yeah, no one's gonna wait 10 seconds to honk. Like that's just something that doesn't happen.
There's not enough traffic in the show.
That's true. There is not enough traffic. We also actually do get the revelation that indeed that camera is actually hooked up to a like some kind of live stream.
It is, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. We have the shaky handheld of the guys following him. And then it turns out there's like three or four angles in the car. I think at some point we see Ira's screen and he's got like three or four angles of
Well,
Jack
Jack
in
is like
the car.
in the passenger seat, and like he like apparently knows that the camera is there, so like he looks up to the right into the cameras to say that he's not gonna shoot Nina. So I like wonder if that there's like a pinhole there that Jack knows about.
Yeah, he's got it all figured out. There was a moment where, and it was in episode 7, there was this interesting moment, you know, where like it's very brief, but like Ira is just watching Jack, and it's like us watching Ira watch Jack. Like the way that the show is mediating through these screens is sort of interesting. And again, I think like even though Spicer doesn't quite use the kind of split screen stuff as much, I think he's kind of doing that in frame a little bit with some of this stuff, where Hopkins would maybe separate some of that out. So I thought that was like kind of an interesting moment where we just sort of are like there's all this mediation going on through this surveillance. But then of course, like, you know, the Tony moment, like the restroom is like, you know, these things can be tricked, right? Like there are loopholes and things. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing sort of running through that 7th episode in particular.
Yeah, I agree. But like, and there's a sort of like I like how it sort of explains the surveillance stuff, but also leaves other things to magic. Like, I still don't know if like how Ira got into the hospital surveillance. Like, because Jamie specifically says that she was gonna do surveillance for CTU. I mean, obviously that's a more shielded location, but still.
Well, I would assume, you know, he's got his guys, and like
Yeah, there's a
when
there's an
at the
enormous
speech and stuff, there's a bunch of them, they're crawling over the place. So, you know, maybe he just like got someone in working as an orderly or whatever, and then they tapped the camera.
That's true.
Like it probably wouldn't be that hard at a hospital, you know, whereas CTU is much more high security, got to get someone on the inside already.
Yeah, speaking of that beach, I also find it funny that a guy's just waiting there like with the laptop at a bus stop, just whoever, however, how long.
Okay, but can we talk about, I'm sorry, I'm cutting you off. I feel like I'm cutting you off a lot.
It's fine.
But it was so funny to me when Aaron Pierce checks the laptop. And it's like, Jack's all freaking out. There's nothing. He opens the laptop. Everything's fine. And it's like, oh, what was this? What is going on? And then he meets with the fake photographer guy. And the guy just lifts up the laptop itself. And it's like, oh, the gun was underneath the whole time. It's like, Aaron Pierce is not very good at this.
Yeah,
you didn't check. You didn't have him, like, pull the laptop out. I was so confused by that. I was just, I got a kick out of it.
And the music is sort of like, it's baiting you to thinking that it's a bomb, like,
yeah,
just with every single thing. Like when Pierce asked Jack to turn it on,
yeah,
like, it's like ratcheting up further. And apparently you can just turn on a computer by just pressing two buttons.
It's a special CTU computer.
I guess. But going back to the speech, there's like, he apparently just has workers, like people masquerading, either actual workers or people masquerading as workers to keep an eye on Jack. But also, yep, we get the very funny thought of Jack in high school. Like, it's just such a random thing just to have him bump into some high school classmate. Apparently, this is the only episode that she's in. And, like, you just get, like, it's sort of like a misdirect because Jack is trying to get the message to her and he doesn't get it. But also just, like, incredibly funny to think of Jack Bauer in high school racing motorcycles.
I loved that. Are you still racing motorcycles? Not since my daughter was born. Yeah,
this makes me think of, like, a American Graffiti starring Jack. Like he's racing motorcycles instead of trucks. Like, is he, like, Harrison Ford's character in that, or what?
How old do you think Jack Bauer is in this first season? Is that ever addressed?
I don't think it's mentioned in the episode. The wiki says that he was born in 1966. So, Like 80s, early 80s when he was in a high school.
So Jack Bauer is slightly younger than my dad.
Yeah, he's slightly younger than my dad, too.
Yeah.
Younger than my mom, actually, also.
I like the idea of, like, because, you know, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've seen, like, high school pictures of my parents and stuff like that. And I'm really liking this idea for, you know, Jack Bauer, the high school years. It's the early to mid 80s, and I'm in Los Angeles. He's racing motorcycles around. Yeah, this leads to all kinds of questions, like, what was Jack's home life like as a kid? What did his parents do? Was this lady like a high school, like, flirtation, or is she just kind of a person who knows him? Like, did he go to a big high school? Did he go to a small high school?
He doesn't strike me
as a guy that goes to high school reunions. So maybe that's one of the reasons she's so, like, surprised and happy to see him. Mm-hmm. I mean, apparently he must have been, like, a cool, popular guy in high school. Mm-hmm. That's the vibe I get.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm
motorcycles.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't know if I'm bringing any of this up too early, but I'm just looking at the, because there's a lot apparently in findings at CTU. Might have to read this also. apparently, Jack attended UCLA and graduated with a degree in English literature.
No shit. Wow.
But then he changed, he turned coat like I did, and he received a MS in criminology and law from Berkeley.
Wow. we really are the representations of the two parts of Jack Bauer's brain. This is the best combination for this podcast. I had no idea. Do you think that was, like, a character note that the writers gave to Kiefer, or do you think he came up with it? That sounds like something he came up with, you know? Like, oh, I always wanted to study English literature, you know? Oh, man, now I'm going to be looking out for, like, does Jack, like, ever talk about? Like, do we ever see Jack, you know, like, reading Faulkner or something in his study?
Speaking of, like, looking at Jack, does he actually eat from the brunch table?
He has still not eaten anything. I think he's
like pouring a cup of coffee, but I don't think he actually drinks it.
No, he has, as far as I can tell, and I could be wrong, I could have missed something, but I've been very attentive to this. Jack Bauer has not eaten anything. Now, It is only just the morning, you know, if you've ever stayed up all night, and not eat, you know, your body sort of like naturally, you know, is used to not eating for that long period of time during the night, even if you're active. Like, he's probably hungry at this point, but we have not seen him eat any food. I don't think really anybody aside from Milo has eaten anything of significance, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean,
Sherry Palmer is always like has a cup of something.
Like, is it orange juice? Is it a mimosa? I can't quite tell, like, what she has in that old-fashioned glass. Highball glass, I think.
Yeah, and I think in some earlier episodes, she has, like, a mug that she carries around with her. You know, like, maybe some tea or something that. But I think that's just, like, Penny Johnson-Gerald, like, doing some good, like, gestures, acting, you know, having a prop to kind of do. And we haven't really commented on the Palmer thing, but I do love her kind of slow reveal as kind of, like, the
blackmail,
the like conniving like mastermind behind Palmer's political career, because now it sort of seems like how many things had she taken care of behind the scenes to keep him clean, you know?
Right
I love that aspect of her character, this kind of, you know, dark like this darkness that she exudes particularly in these two episodes.
Also on the Palmer stuff, I think that still the Keith stuff and like him claiming that Palmer was absent, like, it makes sense, but it also still doesn't quite work for me. But I like the scene with Nicole, like, it's sort of like more intimate and like him promising to protect her, like, that stuff works for me. I think they play it well, but like still the Keith stuff, it's still like they're relying on it and it's not quite coming together.
It's not a super compelling plot, although I will say that I think one of the things is that it has suffered a great deal from the, you know, classic 24 red herring reversals of like, ooh, what has Palmer done that's bad? And then it's like, oh, this isn't actually a bad, like, it's really kind of sad. Mm-hmm. And but I will say that the confrontation between David and Keith over, you know, like basically policing. Right, the idea that if they think I killed this white boy, I'm going to jail. And then David Palmer is like, have a little trust in the system, son. Oh, and God. It's like, damn. That was a rough moment.
It was rough.
And I don't know if this is intentional or not, but I do think that for me anyways, the previous episodes have kind of built Palmer up as sort of being in the right here and like being a little justified and feeling kind of betrayed. But now there's this element of like there's a type of careerist who doesn't know they're a careerist, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think he's that kind of person. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even necessarily know that he's hopelessly naive, but rather that it really is important to him that he salvages his political career. And that, you know, maybe he does believe that, you know, all will out, and if his son's telling the truth, then everything will be fine, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I mean, back to just Mr. Too Damn Principled, you know, he does seem a bit intractable here. I mean, that whole exchange is one of those moments where the politics of the show just get really weird and scrambled, because it's a show that, because of like the intense moments that it creates, it always kind of like hides the political way in some way. Like, it's a very political show, but it's not. It's very rarely about anything like really political. So these weird moments in these exchanges that feel like this, like, that was just a moment that really stuck out, because it kind of changed the dynamic of what this debate is actually about. And that's another thing too, they keep flip-flopping. It's like, oh, you weren't there, you're an absent father, and now it's about like the criminal justice system. And
it's like specifically about the jury also, like, which is a you know, like, that's like a different, I mean, it's obviously very interrelated with policing, but like, it's still like, I mean, also a question of like where it would take place, you know, like in just in terms of like what sort of jury is Keith trying to think of, like, you know, like, there's just like all these things that like are sort of invoked, but also not quite invoked. So like, it's not quite a it's not quite there.
Yeah, and I mean, I was just going to say, like, one of the problems with it is that, you know, this is the eighth episode of the show, and the Palmer storyline is not eight episodes worth of material, you know?
Yeah.
But it does get us to this speech that, you know, like, because I can imagine a slightly different version of the show where this is the first episode where we even see David Palmer, right? And it's like, there's this political figure, he's in danger, he's going to give a speech.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
And then, like, there he is, right? Like, it, obviously, like, it, again, my memory's a little fuzzy, but I do remember that at some point the Palmer and Bauer connection becomes much clearer, like, why we've been following these two characters when Palmer is, like, sort of separate from everything else.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, at the very least, this moment does bring some tension to the speech that isn't just from, like, is Palmer going to get shot or assassinated or whatever. Like there's like some drama being built there that I think, even though it doesn't always work, I think it's like trying to do some work for the plot and for the characters, at least to like get us to this point where things converge.
Yeah. Speaking of the speed, because I've been looking out for these sort of like time discrepancies, and I found he's like being introduced like right before the commercial break, but he doesn't actually come on the screen, like onto the podium for until like 5 minutes after. Like it's just,
maybe someone gave one of those like pre-speeches, right?
Yeah. Like maybe there was another pre-speech.
Maybe they had like Michael Moore or someone up there. Who is the like LA celeb that would be doing hype for David Palmer on Super Tuesday in 2001?
I mean, they had Green Day.
Day play one of the rallies.
Now I'm just thinking of when like of like the Bernie sort of intro, like him like thanking the musical guests. Like,
oh yeah. Mommy or something like that. David Palmer coming up being like, "Thank you, Green Day." Except he wasn't at that rally. It was his kids, so you know.
I like how you get a reinforcement of that information for some reason, like in the news reports. Like like there's more news reports obviously, and also it's fun just seeing all the like the news reporters scurrying around with their cameras and things like that. Yeah, I also just like the sort of setup of Jack just in that apparently like the medical closet in that sort of industrial space. It's just it's an interesting one, and I like how he's sort of like rooting around seeing if he can find anything, because I didn't remember how he was gonna actually get Palmer not shot, so I thought is he gonna like make a bomb or something like that, like an improvised bomb. But also it's just like a very fun, like the most direct means possible without actually, well, A, if he was actually gonna like stop it, why did he not, he has a gun, why did he not shoot the photographer? Yeah, like it's not really, there's not really like a, like is he just banking on the fact that there's enough plausible deniability with him not actually harming the photographer himself that will allow him to keep his family alive or something like that? Because like otherwise it's just like very, it's very obvious like when you're reaching for the gun, like it's a good way of getting Palmer shielded and all that, but still like it's a bit nebulous.
I mean, yeah, it sort of seems like he's kind of desperately searching for a way out that A, protects Palmer, and B, protects his family. So he needs something that's like less straightforward than his normal answer, which is just like shoot people.
Yeah.
Because yeah, the easiest way to protect Palmer would just be to kill the photographer, you know, but then your family's dead. So yeah, I kind of, when he went for the gun, it's sort of like, maybe what he's banking on is that like Ira isn't going to know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And if they were looking for Jack, like, I mean, to me, the easiest way, and maybe, you know, maybe not the easiest, but like, so let's game this out. So Jack gets taken away by the Secret Service people. The photographer shoots Palmer anyways. They can't really frame Jack for that because obviously they'd know, right? So Palmer would be dead, and then probably Jack's family would also just be dead because they don't need Jack anymore. So it's like he has to prevent Palmer being shot in order to protect his family, because as long as Palmer's alive and he's useful to them. So maybe he's just kind of banking on that. He's doing some psychology to be like, if Ira doesn't get what he wants, he still knows I'm useful, you know. But yeah, it did feel a little bit like, okay, writers, how are you going to get out of this one? You know?
Yeah.
I don't think we'll see the photographer again. I think he's just gone forever after this. But I do love that, you know, we got to see the fulfillment of the plastic surgery plotline, which is a very, you know, very classic soap opera trope, and also Star Trek for some reason. So it was nice to see that, you know, kind of come to a head in this episode.
It's also funny seeing the sort of isolated bits of like words of surgery operations, procedures in the key card. Like you just accept them and things like that.
Yeah.
Must have been like insanely elaborate. I mean, obviously it's the same actor, but still, like, no, it looks good. But also you get him sort of like speaking slightly accented in like different accents, like throughout his moments.
Yeah.
Like, I can't tell if he was like supposed to be his last name is Matijevic, so, but like, is he supposed to be like that one?
Yeah, cuz like the photographer is what, like Belgian or something, or German, or
German, I think.
Something else I think that they were doing, maybe it was just looked weird on my TV, but it seemed like they put extra makeup on him a little bit, like particularly like, you know, the like base layer seemed to be a little more artificial looking, I think, to kind of like make him look less naturalistic than the photographer did in those early scenes. Of course, by this time, I mean, both for you and I and the viewers of the show, it's been forever since we've seen the guy that this guy's pretending to be.
Yeah, that's also true.
Yeah, so like, I'm not sure how much any of that matters, but I like, you know, I think they were trying to do some nice little detail touches with like the accent stuff and things like that. And also, like, you know, this guy just like disappears now. Does he just like go off and live his life like as this photographer?
That's a fun thought. I also just like the gun. It's like a very, it's just fun seeing guns assembled. I don't know, it reminded me of Rogue Nation or something like that, like the office scene. It's like that sort of a I mean, like, I also like just how much you see Jack's hands shake in that scene, like just how much stress he's under. Like, that's a good touch. There's a lot of good touches. Like, there's a weird a Stephen Hopkins thing that he noticed is like when Nina and Tony are reunited, there's a weird sort of like pan down, like to show like their hands. It doesn't really feel like part of the scene, like it's an interesting sort of like suggestion of intimacy that the that the show's like ought to have, like considering that they're in a relationship. But there's a
this wasn't as, you know, a lot of plot stuff in these episodes.
Yeah, that's true.
At some point Kim says, I think it's Kim, Kim says people break out of prison all the time.
Yes.
Which seems like a good summation of her character's, you know, ideas about the world.
Like, there's a weird sort of like the Kim stuff, like it's also like, it's just like, it's sort of like her character is like, it feels like more fluid or like more like rootless. Like, I can't quite get a handle on her. Like, she's like both sort of smart but also sort of naive. Like, there's a weird imbalance, like which is also in the, especially evident in these two episodes.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, I mean, there's something of the, like, you know, she's a young person and is, like, torn between kind of the, like, naive notions of childhood and then this kind of, like, situation that has forced her to act in adult ways that that she wasn't expecting, you know. I think that gets a little more interesting when we get to see Terry and Kim together.
Yeah.
Because that hasn't really happened. And you kind of get the sense of like the strains on their relationship.
In that reconciliation scene, it's sort of goofy because Kim is saying like she says, is something bad gonna happen? It's like something already as bad as happening. People are kidnapped you with guns. Like,
I mean, I feel like that. Some of the moments there fall somewhere on the spectrum of like either this kind of reversion to childhood because the parent figure has arrived, and also just like, I don't know whether to blame, you know, Elisha Cuthbert for this or the writers, but there are just moments here for Kim that don't work. I think, like, again, it's like this portion of her plot in some ways is being resolved, and it's being resolved by uniting with her mom, and like those moments work okay. They work much better when you still see the tension kind of like like coming to the surface than when it's sort of like these more weepy kind of intimate moments.
I'm glad that she got to nap for about half an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. More people need to sleep in this show. Like that's just a great way to just like have a character that you don't have to worry about for a little bit. It's like they've been up for a while, you know, they're probably sleepy.
I also like the Rick just finding a piece of chalk like on his shelf
somewhere. Yeah. yeah, that was great. I don't think I already shared the account and quote, and then Palmer's have a little faith in the system. Yeah, nothing else really in the quotes really hopped out to me. I mean, it was like a really particularly episode 8, fairly dynamic visually and plot wise, and not as dialogue heavy. Although just like in general, the Ira Jack stuff is working really well. Like there's a lot of good moments in there. Oh, this is not a quote, but something that's notable is that Ira is a pinky ring guy. I don't know if I just missed this before or if we just got a particularly notable close-up of his hands at the keyboard.
We get some good close-ups of his hands.
He wears a pinky ring.
Yeah, you just get a lot of good moments of him just on the phone with Jonathan or with Jamie, just for he's just talking for a few seconds and then he just puts it down. Lots of good terseness. But also you get that good moment where he's just like thinking and the split screen just cuts off half of his face. Like that's a good moment of tension.
Yeah, that combination, you know, that Hopkins combo of the split screen and the handheld really leads to some, I think, really good compositions.
Yeah. Terry and Kim holding hands like when they're
and that shot's held like when they're taking them out. I'd have to watch it again, but there seemed to be like less cutting in there and a lot of like kind of intense, almost like kind of documentary or amateur style handheld there. That was I felt like made that pretty compelling. Like, you know, there's probably more cuts than I'm remembering, but I do remember the camera kind of being able to move and kind of linger on things like that.
Oh, also we have to mention that one of the guys who takes them out is Al Leong from Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
He's just there. Yeah,
that's impeccable.
Yeah, I don't think he showed up in previous episodes or like it was like a little like in the background, but he's just there. It's great to see him.
Yeah,
I was like, wait, is that like he just like looked incredibly familiar, but also seemed like, I don't know, like the hiring seemed to skew very much white American or European, sort of like, so it's just weird just seeing him there.
Yeah, a lot of frat boys in Ira's crew. This is the thing about having a lot of henchmen is that you can bring actors in for a quick scene or two, and you don't really notice him because he doesn't really get any moments. I don't know if he returns or not, but for now anyways, you know, he's just kind of in and out. Episode 8 in particular, two thumbs up.
It's sort of like this weird thing, like I think that we're still I still don't know how much of it is sort of like I still laugh a lot when I'm watching this. It's sort of like the appreciation, like where I can't, I don't know, like objectivity in art obviously isn't really a thing, but it's sort of like where I can't really quite tell like how much of it is genuinely like really good or if it's just like really good by 24 standards. Like, you know, I assume that we'll be navigating this a lot over the next number of years, however long this goes.
Yeah, my inclination is that a show like this has two modes that are enjoyable, like putting the question of good aside, but it has two kinds of moments that are enjoyable. One is like when things just go really over the top and wild and you got actors just like chewing the scenery and going nuts. And I love that stuff. And the show does that a lot in later seasons. It's not doing so much of that in this season. It's fairly restrained on that front so far, which leads to the second of good moments, which is when you get kind of these, these interactions like the Ira Jack thing that both like serve to kind of move the plot along but are just like really compelling to watch. And I mean, you know, I don't know enough about acting to make these kind of judgments, but I really do think that Massey in particular is doing great work in this show.
Yeah.
I really enjoy what he's doing. I mean, I know Kiefer Sutherland won the Golden Globe, but I think Massey is really, I think Massey is doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the better episodes. The recent episodes of the show. And not to say that, like, you know, I mean, I think Kiefer Sutherland is obviously always going to be kind of the person around which the rest of the show orbits. But as characters come and go, I think I find myself really latching on to these more sustained interactions that you get amidst all the kind of dumb stuff or goofy stuff or whatever, you know, like whether the show is good or not. I really don't know. I'm trying not to think about that question because then I think That's about fair. How much of the show we still have to watch. So, you know, I'm going to put those kind of judgments aside and just like, you know, trying to enjoy it on like a moment by moment basis. It's the kind of show that I feel like you could sit down and binge in an afternoon or two and not, like, there's not a lot. We're definitely taking this far more seriously than it deserves to be taken. But sometimes that's the best way to do things. So that's where I'm at.
I totally agreed. It'll be fun to when we're actually recording lines up when the episodes, I mean, obviously you're in a different time zone, but still.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be good. So, yeah. Thank you everybody for listening.
Yes. And unlike the people for 6 to 7, please tune into the next episode.
Yes.